Welcome to Writers Radio. I'm Ingrid Rose, host for this program, To Push the Limits of Identity. It was 9:30 in the morning for me in Vancouver when I spoke with poet Pervin Sackett in Mumbai, India. There, it was 11 at night. She told me she often works until midnight in her office in the heart of the city because it's much quieter than during the day. Pervin Sackett is a prize-winning poet. She was inaugural fellow for the Vancouver Manuscript Intensive in 2021. Not only does she push the limits of identity, but also those of genres, writing across the gamut, poetry, essays, fiction, biographies in verse for children, and other hybrid works that have yet to find their name. As you're about to hear in our conversation, naming is very important for this versatile and tireless writer who also teaches literature, curates festivals, and edits poetry magazines. So good to be talking with you, Pervin. Tell me, does your name have a meaning?
Pervin, it's a Persian name of Persian origin, and it means a star. Sakit is actually my pen name. It's my husband's first name that I have adopted when I write. And Sakit is the name of a place in India. Yes, it's the name of a holy religious place. It is where Ram, one of the various avatars of Vishnu, was born. Yeah, so it has religious significance. I didn't want to use my surname or his surname. Surnames here have a lot of connotations of caste and privilege and all of those references, and I wanted to let go of that. Whereas first names don't, so it just made sense for me to take my first name and his first name. And he's done the same. So he goes by Sakit Pervin.
That sounds very yin-yang. I know that you're the curator for the Kala Goda Arts Festival in Mumbai, which is where you live. Mumbai,
yes.
That's where you live. The festival actually happens in the city?
It does. It happens in the heart of Mumbai. And Kala Ghoda translates into a black horse. There's a very large statue of a gorgeous black horse in the middle of the arts district in Mumbai. It's named after that. So the Kala Ghoda Arts Festival, it's a 9-day long festival, and there are several curators looking into different verticals. I look at the literature part of it. We just finished. It was fabulous and exhausting. Like most things, you know, when you live intensely, you die a little.
It felt well, a bit I think you're like very that. Courageous to do an interview shortly after this. But you also, it's not like you just do one thing. You're the poetry editor of the Bombay Literary Magazine, which has been going for about 10 years.
Yes, it has. It has been going for 10 years, and it's been quite a journey. It first ran in a very minimalistic format. I joined about 2.5 years earlier. After that, we collectively managed to secure a grant, and we got some funding.
You said that these days, if language must be employed at all, it must be for its ability to transcend, to push the limits of identity, which is why I prefer to shed the noun for the verb, because it's act-oriented rather than identity-oriented.
Right, right, yes. Thank you for reminding me of that. In fact, I have a poem that speaks to that. It's called The Names of Things. Thank you. The names of things are stories distilled into letters, some bent, some proud, with bindis on their foreheads, all waiting to burst through the seams of ink. The names of things are ancient, pillars rooted in histories of owning and fragmenting, lineage and language, boxed identities of belonging. The names of things are sensual, like Afrin or silhouette, the double T of butter, melting, dissolving, sizzling in a bed of a warm mouth. The names of things are counterfeit, like rice containing ice, but none of the soft, gelatinous nourishment of a pulao, garnished with the banter of cousins. The names of things are borders, past which I seek that nounless language, where north is to find, where leg is to walk, where even God is a verb.
India is a country that is caste-ridden, as well as suffering from colonialism. Some of your poems touch on this.
Yes, they do. It paints a different kind of significance with this experience, this idea of categories and kinds.
Yes, well, you bear a Persian name.
It is true that majority of the population in India would belong to the Hindu, they would follow the Hindu religion or belong to that group, but there are very large numbers who do not. I come from a family, a lineage that follows the Zoroastrian faith, and Zoroastrianism is one of the oldest religions in the world, predating all of the prophets that are followed by a different group. It is also one of those that is followed by perhaps the smallest number of people now. In India, we have only about 50,000 Zoroastrians left.
I really appreciate your ability to slip into the consciousness of other kinds of people. I'm looking at the one Slum Roots at Kufa.
Yes, so Kuff Parade is this very upscale, very elite neighborhood in Mumbai. And we have, I don't know if this is particular to cities in North America, but what we have in several large cities in India is that these wealthy neighborhoods are often surrounded by what we call bastis, or slums, or clusters where it's the same pin code. So it has the premium of real estate, but these are people who are doing the jobs of drivers or working in people's homes or nannies. Although they are neighbors in a sense, the divide is so stark.
Tum ibadat ho amanat meri har janam jaane man na jaane ja tu hai meri dua.
Slum Roots at Kuff Parade, Mumbai. Each year we extend foot by crawling foot, while their skyscrapers prod the clouds, our tarpaulin roofs expand onto what they must call the beach. Not the kind of coast they could power walk on, just enough sand for our nets to rest between bouts of catching their dinners, which they will pick at along with dwarfed carrots, baby potatoes, diced mushrooms, and all things small. All fruits and roots know to grow in an intuitive harmony. The branches can only rise as high as the roots are wide. So we inhale from the soil and pass along assorted nutrients through air-conditioned otis columns of piped music and automated doors are closing. And the branches make green, reaching for the sun, sprouting flower and coin. Sometimes a creeper will wind its way along that concrete trunk. And as long as it is obliging, with quiescent leaves and a joke of a spine, it may make its way to the first branch and wrap itself around a subsidiary or a daughter. They'll hire then the exterminator from among our neighbors and sell the daughter a visa to lands where skyscrapers sprout without these upstart roots. They say we blot their sea, blot their pavements. We say they block the sun, block the moon. But the stars in their radial generosity glint above us all. And we drink this hope by the pint so we may sleep. We cannot afford to imagine that those stars are also the suns of other worlds. And in those worlds, another skyscraper might be blocking out another sky.
So you're very aware of the material conditions around you. And yet you also have a very spiritual approach.
I don't think they are antithetical. I think a sensitivity to the spirit in all of us will bring about a recognition of these injustices. They work quite harmoniously and play and layer these my understandings in very interesting ways. I do find that I am drawn towards the quieter poems more rather than the issues. Perhaps even in this selection, some of the poems that touch upon these in a more vocal way or a more direct way are perhaps my earlier poems. Recently, I have an inward shift. All of these will occupy that space as well, but it's just one of those quiet observations about the self.
Yes, and it seems to me your activism is through your teaching and through your curating, but it's through words, it's through writing. Would you like to read one of your more, what you consider quieter?
I'll read a poem which I think speaks to these same ideas of connecting with each other and dissolving separations and boundaries and borders, but perhaps in a slightly different way. This poem is called "What is Your Good Name?" This is a very Indian thing to say. When we meet each other, we are unlikely to say "What is your name?" But we'll say "What is your good name?" Because in India we have two kinds of names. So we have the good name, which translates into Shubh Naam, which actually means auspicious name. Good is an easy shortcut. It actually means auspicious name, which is your formal name. And then there's a pet name, which is the name that is used in your home. So I'm often asked, also because I have an unusual name in India, what is your good name? So this poem is in response to that. What is your good name? I must start with the story of how Ma wanted to name her children after gods. So with her last breath, when she'd call out to her faraway brood, and she was certain she would, the gods would think she's reaching for them and grant her moksha. Instead, the astrologer charted the paths of the stars at my first breath and extracted from the thick of those constellations the syllables that would fall on my ears, all my ears, like a whirling mantra. But my true name is neither sound nor subterfuge. To know it, you will need to learn a dialect of silence. Not muffled withdrawal or bubbling secrecy, but the vernacular of the grass noiselessly opening yet another blade. The idiom of the wind when it meets neither tree nor bird, just expanses of inhale, exhale. In this tongue of self knowing self, my true name will form its sound, and you will be able to spell it using the letters of your name. Is it also the same impetus, the same push to merge and to dissolve these ideas of separation? And because I work with language and names matter so much, it is true, your name and my name is finally the same name.
Now for Pervin Sackett's feminist spin on an Indian epic poem.
The novel is called Urmila. And Urmila is the name of a woman who, from the epic, the Ramayana. And the Ramayana is really the story of Ram, which is why the word Ramayana, which means story of Ram. And Urmila occupies only two lines in the original epic, which was written by Valmiki. It's so difficult to talk about it in this linked manner, because it's all over the place, this epic. There are several reasons because of which this protagonist, Ram, has to go into exile. He has to leave his kingdom, where he's the prince, and go into exile. And his younger brother, Lakshman, follows him. And Urmila is Lakshman's wife. And they have an arranged marriage, and she falls in love with her husband. The arranged marriage has these curious, has these vows. They are vows that you knowingly, deliberately, wholeheartedly make to your spouse. She realizes that the vows that Lakshman had made to her, he wasn't really free to make those vows because he already felt that strongly, and he was already committed in another way to his brother, in a way that he was not free to commit to her. So that becomes the central idea of my book, which is not addressed in the original epic. She's just a side character who's mentioned as a wife, and it ends over there. But this is an imagining of how it must have been for her. Also because this brother relationship is one which is even today upheld as ideal in India. And now when we look at it from a modern lens, it seems dysfunctional, it seems excessive, it seems like one is shadowing another, and it seems like it's swallowing all these other important relationships. That's the space from where the novel really begins. The poem is called Urmila Asks a Question. So this is how it goes.
Luna.
Urmila asks a question. They never hear it, of course. Since 30,000 verses over 7 volumes are too busy with the gods of men and the triumph of an unsettling good. Urmila asks a question that hides between the first poet's chants, where devotion towards a brother ignores the desertion of a wife, in pauses taught with hidden pleas. Urmila asks a question, which, like the flutter of a sparrow, shatters into stillness, in an air too strong with rhetoric to sustain the flight of this wingless whisper. The question crackles of sacred vows, of an orange fire and a hollow promise. It sobs, half bride, half widow, half blessed, half cursed, hand against hand, cheek against cheek, limb against limb. It stinks like the marigolds crushed under their heaving bodies. They will never hear the question, only the distressed, disturbed air that it breathes, only its blatant, bold tenor. They will never know its words, each aching, sour, lonely syllable. For them, it is outrage enough that Urmila asks a question.
That was Pervin Sackett's poem, Urmila Asks a Question, turning the Indian epic poem, the Ramayana, inside out. You've been listening to the versatile writer, Pervin Sackett, reading some of her poetry, coming to us all the way from Mumbai, India. This is Writers Radio. I'm Ingrid Rose. Delighted to have been the host of this program to push the limits of identity. Many thanks and appreciation to my co-producers and co-hosts, Carol Harmon and Gary Sill, our music man and technical whiz. And thanks to you for listening.
You have been listening to Writers Radio, a non-commercial collaborative project which presents talented writers reading their own work. These stories, essays, and conversations revisit the long tradition of oral storytelling that connects us to the inspiration behind the words. Be sure to check the website, writersradio.ca, to subscribe to our free notifications list. It's also a way of letting the writers know you are there and appreciating their creative work.
Writers Radio broadcasts from Half Moon Bay on the Sunshine Coast in Canada, traditional tribal land of the Shishel Nation of the Coast Salish peoples. We express our gratitude for their wisdom teachings and land stewardship.